Good afternoon. My name is Brittany Jarrett, and this is Isabel Weber. We are both seniors in the Division of Nutritional Sciences and members of HealthNuts, an undergraduate student organization affiliated with the Division of Nutritional Sciences, which aims to promote health and nutrition across Cornell's campus and into the Ithaca community.
On behalf of HealthNuts and the Cornell University Division of Nutritional Sciences, we would like to welcome you all to the inaugural Joyce Lindauer Wallitzer Class of 76 and Stephen Wallitzer Nutrition Seminar featuring Dr. Marion Nessel. The opportunity to bring Dr. Nessel to campus was made possible through the thoughtful generosity of Mrs. Joyce Lindauer Wallitzer, an alumna of Nutritional Sciences from the class of 1976, and her husband, Mr. Stephen Wallitzer, in honor of her 35th reunion in 2011. The Joyce Lindauer Wallitzer Class of 76 and Stephen Wallitzer Nutrition Seminar was established to enhance the experience of students studying nutrition and to expand their career horizons. This is the first of three lectures to be given over the next several years. Through the Wallitzer support, HealthNuts has been given the opportunity to invite accomplished and high-profile speakers in the field of nutrition to campus. In addition to delivering a lecture, the invited speaker engages with undergraduate students, graduate students, and faculty in the Division of Nutritional Sciences throughout his or her visit, as Dr. Nessel has done today. While they could not have been here today, please join me in thanking the Wallitzers for making Dr. Nessel's visit to campus possible.
Dr. Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, which she chaired from 1988 to 2003. She is also a professor of sociology at NYU and a visiting professor of nutritional sciences here at Cornell. She earned a PhD in molecular biology and an MPH in public health nutrition from the University of California at Berkeley. Previous faculty positions were held at Brandeis University and the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine. From 1986 to 1988, she was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and editor of the Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. Her research examines scientific and socioeconomic influences on food choice, obesity, and food safety, emphasizing the role of food marketing. She is the author of three prize-winning books, including Food Politics: How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, Safe Food: The Politics of Food Safety, and What to Eat. Her most recent book, to be released in March 2012, is called Why Calories Count: From Science to Politics. She writes the Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle, blogs daily at foodpolitics.com, and twitters at Marion Nessel. In 2011, the University of California School of Public Health at Berkeley named her as a public health hero. Time magazine included her Twitter among its top most influential 140 and its top 10 in health and science. Writing for Forbes, Michael Pollan ranked her as the number two most powerful foodie in America after Michelle Obama, and Mark Bittman ranked her number one in his list of foodies to be thankful for. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Marion Nessel.
Thank you so much for that nice introduction, and thank you to HealthNuts for the invitation. This is really a great honor, and particularly because the invitation came from undergraduate students here, and I'm just very pleased to be giving the inaugural Wallitzer lecture. Part of it is to give undergraduate students some ideas about careers in nutrition, and mine is kind of a weird one, so I thought I would say just a little bit about it. I started out in food and nutrition because I just really loved food. I loved to eat. When I went to college, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I couldn't figure out how you could study nutrition. And so I ended up with a PhD in molecular biology. And in my first teaching job, I was given a nutrition course to teach. And as I like to put it, it was like falling in love. I could see that nutrition was such a fun way to teach biology to undergraduate students. Not only that, but you could link biology to history, sociology, what was going on in politics, and everything else in the world. And in that very first course, I used these two books, Diet for a Small Planet, which is still in print, and Food for People, Not for Profit, a book that was put out by Center for Science and the Public Interest in 1975. Both of those books were used in my first course in 1976, and they linked agriculture to food, to nutrition, and to public health in a way that made complete sense to me, and my career ever since has done the same thing. In the last 10 years, I've done a bunch of books on these kinds of topics, and as a university professor, like all university professors, I'm required to do research, teach, and public service around the issues of my specialization. And I spend about half my time teaching and writing books and articles, and the other half on public service. And by public service, I mean lectures like this one. I do a lot of media interviews with reporters. I answer questions all day long from students, from reporters, and from everybody else. I write a newspaper column, I blog, and I do, even though I don't understand anything about it, I use Twitter. Last two books that I've done in conjunction with Mal Nesheim, who's here. Mal, raise your hand, please. My co-author on my last two books. And we had such good time writing Feed Your Pet Right, which is not actually a book about pet feeding. It's a book about how to analyze. It's an analysis of the pet food industry. We had such a good time doing it that we thought we'd do another one. And when University of California Press suggested that I write a book on calories, I invited Mal to do it with me, and we had a great time doing this one, too. The book's publication date is April 1st, so you're getting a preview, a pre-publication preview, although I understand that books are coming into bookstores even as we speak. One of the reasons why we were interested in doing a book about calories is that calories are involved in what I would consider to be the two most important food issues facing the world population today, and both of them link science to agriculture, to nutrition, to public health, and public policy. So all of these issues are linked together. And the first of these is food insecurity. About 1 billion people in the world don't have enough food to eat on a daily basis to meet their needs. On the other hand, in the great irony of current nutrition life, about 1 billion people have so much to eat that they're overweight and have developed risk factors for chronic diseases. And I also think that food marketing and food advocacy are very important nutrition issues these days, both of them related to food insecurity and obesity. In this talk, I'm not going to be speaking about food insecurity. That's a whole talk on its own. But I am going to be talking about obesity, food marketing, and food advocacy from a calorie standpoint. So let me begin with the starting position about any discussion about calories, which is how hard they are for people to understand. The public is demonstrably confused about calories, and you can understand why when you see these numbers all over the place and you have rap singers doing calories, blah, 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 and there are all those diet books. And the confusion, it seems to me, is quite understandable for a number of reasons. For one reason, there's an enormous diet industry, $60 billion a year, which does everything it can to convince the public that its particular way of cutting calories is likely to be the one that is most effective, or even better, you don't have to cut calories, you just have to eat a certain way, and weight will take care of itself. But there are other sources of confusion about calories as well, and some very, very prominent academics and journalists have written books in the last few years that have very odd views of calories, it seems to me. For example, the distinguished historian Nick Culleather, in his book Hungry World, which is a sort of a political science book, he's a historian of political science, and he's really writing about the Cold War, talks about calories as an instrument of government dominance and control. If governments measure calories, this is a way that they can control their populations. The historian Jessica Moudry thinks that calories are anti-cultural. She's writing a history of calories, but her book Measured Meals talks about how calories are reductionist. They reduce the taste of food and the cultural experience of food to a mere number. The journalist Gary Taubes, in his book Good Calories, Bad Calories, thinks that calories are irrelevant. It doesn't matter how much you eat. What really matters is what you eat. And if you want to lose weight, you cut out carbohydrates, because everything about weight is about carbohydrates and insulin resistance. And the anthropologist Richard Wrangham says that calories are miscounted because there are more calories in food that's cooked than calories that's raw. We can go into the science about this later, but these are all non-scientists writing about these topics. And yet, if you go onto the web and ask for a definition of calories, this is the first thing that pops up on Google Images. And even if you dig a little deeper in Google Images and go to the edited version, you get something that's equally confusing. Units of heat measurement equivalent to 1.1480 joules? What are they? So if the public wants to understand calories, this is not a very easy concept to understand. And even the official definition itself and the very name of calories is designed for maximum public confusion, because a calorie isn't a calorie at all, it's a kilocalorie, at least the ones that are on nutrition facts labels. Even though they're called calories, they're not. They're kilocalories, a number 1,000 times greater. And so the official definition of a calorie, a capital C or kilocalorie calorie, is the heat energy needed to raise the temperature of a kilogram of water by 1 degree centigrade from 14.5 to 15.5 degrees centigrade at 1 unit of atmospheric pressure. No wonder nobody understands what they are. We in the book go to a fair amount of trouble to translate this definition into something that somebody could possibly understand. And the first approach to a translation is to get rid of the 14.5 to 15.5 degrees centigrade and forget about atmospheric pressure, translate kilograms into quarts, and then you have, it's about the amount of heat that's needed to raise the temperature of a quart of water by 1 degree centigrade. That's not bad. But let's talk about 100 calories, because nobody really can talk about one calorie in food. And 100 calories is the amount of heat needed to bring a quart of water to a boil. What? 100 calories is the number of calories in 2 Oreo cookies. You eat 2 Oreo cookies, and 1 quart of the 6 or 7 quarts of blood in your body, there's enough energy to raise it to a boil. Why don't you boil if, as many people do, you eat the whole package? You don't boil because of metabolism, because metabolism taps off the heat energy that comes in from food in little tiny amounts that keep you warm and keep your body temperature up, but don't boil you. Okay, try explaining metabolism to somebody who doesn't know any chemistry. I defy you to do that. We tried to do that in this book, and I hope some of you will read it and tell us whether we succeeded in making it intelligible or not. We were curious to know how anybody figured any of this out. And we went back and read some history, and it was really fun to dig into the old musty books in the library here and read Hippocrates. It was a physician and scientist who worked, who did his work and did his writings, or did writings that were attributed to him in about 400 BC. And he was really interested in the effect of food on the body, particularly relating food to heat. And there was no question that food was related to heat. And this is one of his most famous aphorisms: growing creatures have the most innate heat, and that's why they need the most food. And if they don't have enough food, they're going to lose weight and their body will pine away. His work was picked up by Galen about 500 years later. And then after that, we went into the Dark Ages, and nothing much happened about the science of calories for more than 1,000 years, which is interesting in itself. The ancients already knew that food had something to do with body weight, and that food intake had to be balanced with physical activity or energy expenditure. And if they were balanced, weight stayed about the same. If you ate more food than you were expending in physical activity, you were going to gain weight. And if you weren't eating enough, you were going to pine away, with some individual variation. So all of this was known thousands of years ago. But the real science of calories didn't really start until the 16th century with Sanctorius of Padua, who I think must have had a really extreme form of a compulsive disorder, because this man weighed everything he ate, everything he drank, his urine, his feces, and his body every single day for 30 years. Those of you who are graduate students should be very happy that he's not your supervisor. The real science of calories began in the 18th century, and this is Antoine Lavoisier, who was really responsible for developing a functioning calorimeter, something to measure calories, and he burned food in this device and measured the change in temperature of a surrounding water bath, and could show that the amount of calories that were in the food, produced by the food, in the calorimeter were equivalent to the heat produced by an animal in the same calorimeter chamber who was eating food and going about its daily business. This was a direct calorimeter that measured calories from the change in temperature of the water bath. Unfortunately, Lavoisier's experiments were cut short by the French Revolution. He was guillotined, and that put an end to a very promising scientific career. And that's Lavoisier and Madame Lavoisier in a very famous portrait. Fast forward 100 years to the work of Wilbur Atwater, who drew on the work of a bunch of German and other chemists to build a calorimeter that was big enough to house a person, and using that calorimeter, measuring the change in temperature of water, and also measuring the respiration of that person, how much oxygen was consumed. This was a direct anaerobic respiration calorimeter, was able to make an astonishing number of measurements. Anybody who writes about calories immediately has to read the work of Wilbur Atwater, which I can only say is awe-inspiring. Atwater is rightly considered the father of modern nutritional science, and we dedicate our book to his memory. For those of you who are experimental scientists, his output was prodigious. From the late 1800s until the early 1900s, sorry. He didn't live quite that long. From the late 1800s to the early 1900s, he conducted a series of extraordinary experiments in which he measured the calories in food, the calories in alcohol, the total number of calories consumed by people on a daily basis, the amounts lost in digestion, he measured that. He measured losses in excretion. The number of calories used by a person in the calorimeter at rest, essentially basal metabolic rate, and those used in activities. And as a result of that, he was able to develop predictions for the number of calories that were used by people working at different occupations, and to develop a lot of calorie science, which has remarkably held up to this very day. His monographs were hundreds of pages long. He reviewed thousands of studies worldwide that other people had done and put it all together into these really quite astonishing monographs. His monographs his work is also remarkable for the careful scientist that he was. He's famous, of course, for his Atwater values, 4 calories per gram for protein and carbohydrate and 9 calories per gram for fat. But in presenting the data, and this is from an 1899 paper, he shows what happens if you burn the protein, fat, and carbohydrate in a calorimeter. He applies a correction factor for digestion and then comes out to total nutrients and comes out with the factors of 4, 8.9 for fat. It was later corrected to 9, and then 4 for carbohydrate. But what is so impressive about this is the way he talks about his own science. These figures are not to be regarded as final. Alterations may be called for as data accumulate. We spend a lot of time in the book talking about subsequent attempts to try to refine Atwater values. All of them failed. Meanwhile, he said, we think that they are sufficiently accurate for ordinary use. And this is one of the major themes of our book, is that whatever the calorie estimates are, they're probably good enough for most purposes, even if they're not very precise. And the reason that they're not very precise is because there's a big difference between calories that are measured and calories that are estimated. A very big difference for the most part. Atwater, again, the precise scientist, said that the Atwater factors are simply tentative and based on the best data they're able to obtain. They were pretty good. And he, this particular table from that same 1899 publication shows Atwater values, or the calories per gram, for a whole bunch of different kinds of sugars. He was way ahead of his time on the whole carbohydrate issue. And he showed that the calories in various sugars ranged from about 3.7 to close to 4.4. And then if they were done assuming on the basis of weights or calculated in some other way, the numbers were a little higher sometimes a little lower, but in general they ranged around 4, so that 4 was a reasonable approximation for the calories in carbohydrate. But the issue of measured versus calculated is really a critical one that comes up over and over and over again in many of the arguments that there are about calories, and part of the strange ideas about the academics who are not scientists who write about calories comes from the fact that they don't make a clear distinction between what's measured and what's estimated. The discrepancy between reported and actual calorie intake and expenditure is famous, and everybody knows that if you ask people how much they eat, they lie. And they underestimate by a very, very large fraction, usually 30 to 40%. It's a huge fraction. And if you ask people how many calories they expend in physical activity, they also tend not to be very accurate about it, although a little bit better. But they overestimate the amount that they're expending. And this becomes an enormous problem in trying to make any sense over what people are supposed to be eating. So the question of how many calories you're supposed to eat is really a complicated one, because calories cannot be seen, they cannot be smelled, and they cannot be tasted. You can only infer the number of calories that you're eating by their effect on your waistline or their effect on the scale. And in fact, the people who manage to diet the best and keep weight off the longest are people who, like Sanctorius, weigh themselves every day and monitor their weight. So if you look at, for example, comes from a table in our book, the average requirements in calories per day, there's a really big difference between measured through doubly labeled water, which is more or less the gold standard for measurement of calorie use. And the gold standard measurements show that on average, men in the United States require about 3,000 calories and women about 2,400. But if you look at estimates based on self-reports or other kinds of measures, the NHANES data, the most recent figures, show that men report 2,600 calories a day, and women 1,900. In 1984, the Department of Agriculture ran another one of those studies that you're glad you're not part of, where they asked a group of volunteers to do 24-hour diet records for 365 days. And that was published in 1984. It's a fascinating study. And the average calories reported in that study was about 2760 for men and 1850 for women. The FDA standard for food labels is 2000. Where did that come from? The FDA made it up, and we talk about how in the book. The NHANES average from that NHANES study is about 2,100 calories, way below what's measured. And older studies, the ones that informed the FDA 2000 figure, showed an average of 2,350. The FDA wanted to use 2,400, but everybody said that's too complicated. It will encourage people to eat too much, particularly women. So the FDA stayed with 2,000, which is clearly way too low. And then there are food supply data. I like food supply data. That's Department of Agriculture figures on the number of calories available in the food supply, less exports plus imports. And they've been keeping those data since 1909. And now in recent years, they've been correcting them for waste, which is about 1,300 calories difference. And so they show that the food supply provides about 2,700 calories if you include waste, but the uncorrected figure is 3,900 calories. And I'll come back to that figure later because it's useful in a number of ways. So big difference between estimation and measurement. And since measurement is complicated and requires isotopes and machinery and other kinds of things, can only be done on a few people at a time. We're stuck with estimates, and the estimates are probably, for most purposes, good enough, is one of the arguments that we have. So that's all I'm going to say about the science, and I'm now going to move on to the politics. And the politics have to do with the politics of obesity. As a nutritionist, I don't know about you, but I am absolutely thrilled by the idea that the First Lady of the United States is interested in the same kinds of things that I am. And not only that, but she's largely interested in them in the right way. She picked childhood obesity as a target for her First Lady action, and she picked within childhood obesity a couple of really good ways to get at it, which is to try to do something about school food and to try to do something about access to healthy food in inner cities. And I know that many of you are working on both of those. The deal about obesity and what you have to do something about it is not so easy to manage. Obesity certainly has genetics as a big factor in it. Not everyone who overeats gains very much weight. Everyone who overeats gains weight, but some people gain much less weight than other people. Body weight is also governed by metabolic regulation, which is so complicated that it's impossible to diagram and it's impossible to talk about, except to say that it's really, really complicated and undoubtedly extremely redundant, meaning that there are lots of different physiological factors that are all conspiring to keep you from losing weight. There's lots and lots of controls that defend against loss of body weight, and a much, much weaker regulatory system for telling you when to stop eating. And the result of that is that in a food environment that encourages overeating, and that's what I'm going to be talking about, it's really hard for most people to maintain their weight. And that's what I want to say a few things about. Now, if you want to do something as an individual about losing weight, you have to eat less, you have to move more, substitute fruits and vegetables for junk food. And I always think it's important to enjoy what you're eating. And please don't eat my book. If it seems more complicated than that, it's surely because of the effect of eat less advice on the food industry. Eating less is very bad for business. And the food industry recognizes this. And in 2007, an executive of Coca-Cola gave an interview to Advertising age in which she referred to obesity as the Achilles heel of the discussion about obesity. Obesity used to be something that they didn't have to pay attention to at all. They just said, personal responsibility. If you're fat, it's your fault. Now it's an enormous global issue. It affects their marketing, and it affects everything else they're doing. It is, as she put it, a huge, huge issue for the food industry. And to understand that, it's important to understand, or I think it helps to understand, how obesity came about. We didn't always have what was considered an obesity epidemic. Prior to the early 1980s, and we can date it pretty precisely, rates of obesity in the United States stayed at about 15%. They're now up to 33% or 38% was the last figure I saw. So the obvious question is, what happened in the early 1980s that made one of two things happen? Either people had to start moving less, or they had to eat more, or they had to do both. So let me deal with the moving less part first. The data, if anything, on physical activity are worse than the data for food intake. Much more, they're just not very good. It's very, very hard to know how much physical activity people are engaging in. Just think about it. Just think about trying to figure out how much physical activity you engage in. And I'm not necessarily talking about going to the gym. I'm talking about just daily walking and physical activities and going up and down stairs and going to classes and so forth. The available evidence, and I'm not going to push this too hard, the available evidence suggests that, if anything, rates of activity have increased a little since the early 1980s. They also suggest that rates of reported inactivity have gone down a little bit since the early 1980s, meaning that, if anything, rates of physical activity haven't changed much, or maybe they're a little higher, but I'm not going to push that. I just don't think there's much evidence for change. There is, however, no question whatsoever that people are eating more now than they did in the early 1980s, and there are two sources of data for this. One is calories in the food supply, the Department of Agriculture's food availability data that they've had for a long time in the 1980s. The number of calories in the early 80s, the number of calories in the food supply per capita was 3,200 a day, plenty to keep the public, to keep the population fed. It's now 3,900 a day or more. The Department of Agriculture, for some reason or other, is no longer reporting those data for calories in the food supply. In any case, the change is an increase of 700 since the early 1980s. This doesn't mean that people are eating 700 calories more a day. It just means that there's more available for everybody. The dietary intake surveys show that in the 1980s, the number of calories on average reported as consumed by the population was 1,900, significantly less. It went up to 2,100 now, and a change of 200 calories. 200 is probably too low because people underestimate what they eat. 700 is probably too high. The truth lies someplace in between. We don't know where exactly, but people are eating more. So let me do the food. One more thing on the food supply data. The pink bar across the middle is 3,200 calories a day available in the food supply, plus or minus a couple of hundred calories. It was like that from the earliest reported dates in the early 1900s all the way to 1980. In 1980, the number of calories in the food supply started to rise quite precipitously. Why? I think two reasons, and they both have to do with political deregulation. The first was deregulation of agriculture in the 1970s. Agricultural policy in the United States changed from a policy that required farmers to put land aside and not grow food in order to get agricultural supports to a system in which farmers were paid on the volume of the quantity of the food that they produced. So this was an incentive for farms to get big. It was an incentive for farms to grow food on every available square inch. Our farmers are really good at dealing with incentives, and the results of that was mountains of corn and a sea of farm subsidies. No administration has ever been able to get rid of them, and it'll be very interesting to see in the discussion about the farm bill this year whether Congress and the president will be able to get rid of at least direct subsidies, which are subsidies to people who don't even farm necessarily. A second one area of deregulation was deregulation of Wall Street. In 1981, Wall Street was overtaken by what was called the shareholder value movement, which was a movement by shareholders of corporations to get immediate higher returns on investment. Up until then, blue chip stocks were very highly praised by Wall Street. Now you never hear anything about blue chip stocks. All you hear about is growth. For food companies who were already trying to sell their products in an environment in which there were 3,900 calories in the food supply, roughly twice average need, or 1.5 times average need, that made the food industry very competitive. But now they had to sell products in an environment in which they not only had to make a profit, but they had to grow their profit every 90 days. And you see the result of that kind of pressure on Wall Street today. But for food companies, it was especially difficult because there was already way too much food and so much more than anybody needed. So the result of that was that food companies had to seek new markets. And in seeking new markets, they changed society in ways that most people didn't even notice. Food was very cheap because of supply and demand, so people began eating outside the home more. Food outside the home has more calories in it than food inside the home. A lot of the increase in food intake, and look, these are still from 1980 to the early 2000s, a lot of that was fast food. Fast food is particularly high in calories. People began eating out more and eating more fast food. They also began eating larger portions. I went to the exhibit on food advisory materials at the National Archives and just adored this. I mean, here I was writing a book about calories, and here was this gorgeous graphic done in 1930 of 100-calorie portions. I looked at this and said, gee, these must have been small plates. Really small plates, if these were 100-calorie portions. On the meat plate, this one over here, medium-fat roast beef, you couldn't put another thing on that plate. Portion sizes have increased. And this, of course, was the work of my doctoral student, Lisa Young, who produced this graph last year of the rise in calories in the food supply, the thing I've already showed you twice, in parallel with rising rates of obesity. The middle curve is rising rates of obesity. And then she looked at introduction of larger portions starting in the early 1980s, where the arrow points. And she could show that starting in the early 1980s, portion sizes started to get bigger, sometimes much bigger. And here's Lisa at a talk that she gave, posed behind some cups that she bought at our local movie theater. And the white cup on the left is the Department of Agriculture single serving cup for a soft drink. It holds 8 ounces and 100 calories if it didn't have too much ice in it. You can't even buy one anymore. All of the others range from 12 ounces to 64 ounces. The 64-ounce double gulp, if it doesn't have too much ice in it, holds 800 calories. And the evidence shows that that cup is not passed down the row in the movie theater. It's consumed by one person. We asked her, she teaches our introductory nutrition class at NYU, and we asked her to give her class a little quiz on this. And she asked her class a really tough mathematical question. How many calories in an 8-ounce in an 8-ounce Coke, and how many calories in a 64-ounce double gulp? And she was absolutely shocked to discover that the average was a multiple of, she didn't expect people to know how many calories there were in the 8-ounce cup, but she was really shocked to find out that the average multiplier was 3, not 8. So we said, Lisa, you have to go back and ask your class how come. And because even the most mathematically challenged student can multiply by 8. And so, especially if it's 8 times 100, that's not hard to do. And so she went back and asked them, and they told her 800 calories in a soft drink is impossible. It's just not possible. If I had one thing that I could teach about nutrition, it would be that larger portions have more calories. You laugh, but that's because you haven't been listening to your colleague, Brian Wansink. And he is able to show without question that portion sizes and the fact that larger portions have more calories is not intuitively obvious. For those of you who have never seen this, this is his Super Bowl experiment, where he invited his own students, who certainly should have known better, to go to his house and watch the Super Bowl. He put half of them in one room with 2-quart bowls of snacks and the other half in another room with 4-quart bowls, and at the end of it he measured how much they ate. And he was able to show that the ones with the larger bowls had eaten almost twice as many calories as those with the smaller bowls, and when he asked them how many calories they ate, they underestimated by a much larger fraction. Now, these were his own trained students. He had taught them that larger portions induce people to eat more calories. And even so, when confronted with a large portion, they unthinkingly went ahead and ate more. So do I, so do you, and so does everybody else. Large portions do one other thing, and that is they're very, very hard to compensate for with physical activity. Here's a 12-ounce, 150-calorie soda. In order to walk it off, you need to walk for an hour at 2 miles an hour, for 45 minutes at 3 miles an hour, or roughly 20 minutes at 5 miles an hour. And even if you're a marathon runner, you're only going to expend about 3,000 calories in the 2.5 hours you, as a pretty reasonable marathoner, are running. And that's only about 1 pound of weight, if you look at it, or a pound of body fat. It takes a lot to compensate for caloric intake, which is why the caloric intake side of the equation is so much more important than the output, even though I'm greatly in favor of physical activity and I think everybody should be more active. Ubiquity is another thing the food industry did. This is a slide I've used for some years. The question is, when did it become okay to eat in bookstores? You can go around Ithaca this week, and you can go to a drugstore, you can go to Bed Bath & Beyond, you can go to Staples. Food is sold at all of those places. One way to expand your market is to sell food everywhere. And even at Cornell, in the library, there are cafes in the library. When I first went to NYU, there were signs all over NYU saying, if you so much as bring any food and drink into this place, you are out of here so fast you won't even know what happened. And now we have 2 cafes and vending machines everywhere in the library. So ubiquity is a promoter of a calorie intake. If the food is there, you will eat it. I wanted to say a word about low prices, because that's a really big impact on food choices. And the example that I've given for years is that if you go to McDonald's with around $5, you can get 5 hamburgers or 1 salad. What is that about? That's about agricultural policy. But for somebody who's poor and who's hungry, who has $5, you can bet that it's an easy choice between the 5 hamburgers and the 1 salad. And if poor people think that, have the perception that fruits and vegetables are expensive, it's because fruits and vegetables are expensive. And these are Department of Commerce data plotting the indexed price of fruits and vegetables from, again, the magic year of 1980 to roughly the present. And what these data show is that the indexed price of fruit and vegetables has gone up by about 40%. Since 1980, whereas the price of beer, butter, and sodas has gone down by 15 to 30%. This is agricultural policy in action, and if we want to change that and promote people eating more healthier calories, we're going to have to change agricultural policy. Adam Dranowski has made a career recently out of distinguishing between high and low calorie foods and their cost per calorie. Low calorie foods have a lot of water in them, and so whatever it is you're paying for water. But he can show that fruits and vegetables are very high relatively on a per calorie basis as compared to shortenings, sugar, and so forth. All of this conspires to make eating healthy calories harder for people who don't have very much money. So these are the kinds of things that I talk about in my books, that we talk about in the calorie book, and that Michelle Simon, who's a lawyer in San Francisco, talks about in her book, Appetite for Profit, how the food industry undermines our health and how to fight back. It's a good book, worth reading. And in it, she talks about the enormous pressure on food companies, from advocates who want them to stop marketing to children, from regulators who want to regulate them, from lawyers who want to sue them, and from Wall Street, which simply wants them to make more money. And food companies have responded by first doing nothing, then going through all the stages of death and denial, and then starting to change products with health to increase their use of health claims and to make so-called better-for-you products. And then behind the scenes, they fight back and lobby and attack advocates and blame inactivity and personal choice and so forth. I'm not going to talk about that at all, but if you want to know about it, you can go on my website and take a look. I post all the letters they write me on my website. I want to start just say a word about health claims, because this is also Brian Wansink's really most interesting work. And he has a paper from 2007 on the biasing health halos of fast food restaurant health claims, that people who see health claims on fast food think that the foods are lower in calories. And subsequently, he's been able to show this with other kinds of health claims, and I've shown a few of them here. Reduced fat means reduced calories, not necessarily. 0 grams trans fat is interpreted as meaning low calorie. And vitamin D and immunity on cereal boxes means the calories are very low and these are health foods. And the same is true for organic labels. People think that organic foods are lower in calories. Health halos. The food industry takes advantage of this. I was fascinated to see in the 2010 dietary guidelines what the major source of calories in American diets were. Grain-based desserts were number one, followed by bread, chicken nuggets, sweetened drinks, pizza, and alcohol. How's that for just exactly what nutritionists are not recommending? No wonder people have a problem with calories. And then the advertising of calories has become really pretty amazing. Mars has just announced that it's going to restrict all of its calories to 250 or less. That means the ones that are now 265 are going to take 15 calories off. That's not going to matter much. And the 100 calorie packs have a very interesting history. They have been researched, and people tend to eat more than one. But it's only 100 calories, right? So 100 calorie packs are an excuse for eating junk food, is what it looks like to me. And then I just saw these recently. Domino's Sugar is now advertising sugar as a health food. It's only got 15 calories. Okay per teaspoon. And Old Mother Hubbard Baking, these are treats for dogs. And they're advertised as only 5 calories each. The biggest health problem among dogs and cats is obesity these days. So I guess this makes sense. And then, of course, media advertising also influences what people eat. And in 2010, companies spent about $14 billion, food companies, food, drink, and restaurant companies spent about $14 billion advertising their products. And it's very hard to get figures on individual products, but I've managed to find a couple. And Kellogg spent $47 million advertising Pop-Tarts last year, and Fruit Loops almost $20 million. And these kinds of things constitute the environment of food choice that David Kessler talks about in his book, The End of Overeating, an environment that he said that hardly anybody can overcome. So we live in an environment in which there's constant stimulation to eat more, and very few of us can do something like this. This is one of the cartoons in our book, I'll pay double for half as much. When was the last time you did that? So that brings me to coping strategies. If you need to do something about weight, you've got to cope with the calorie environment. And our suggestions on this are to get organized and decide you're going to do it and get yourself motivated. You have to not only eat less, but you have to eat better and substitute better food, healthier food for what you're doing, and you need to move more. But we also think that politics is very much part of this, and you need to get political. And the politics of calories these days are very interesting. President Obama, when he signed the Health Care Act, signed in calorie menu labeling in fast food restaurants, and these should be coming soon to a restaurant near you if they haven't already. I think it's supposed to go into effect next year. New York City has had it for a while, and it's been interesting to watch it. We have a health commissioner in New York City who really cares about public health, and is doing everything he can to try to get rates of obesity and heart disease down. And he's got this great campaign about how far you have to walk to burn off the calories in soda, that if you eat a lot of sugar and soft drinks, it's going to make you fat. And there are even calorie labels on people hawking junk food at baseball stadiums. The most recent campaign, very controversial, is on portion size. And the idea is to get people to eat smaller portions and understand that large portions are associated with overweight and disease. And we're in a era, this is the year that the Farm Bill is under consideration, and it's agricultural policy, and there are lots of people who are trying to get the Farm Bill changed to something that will contribute to people managing their weight better and make people healthier. Whether that will work this year, I don't know. We're in an election year. I'm not making any bets. So get political. I think there are loads and loads of things that people can do. When I met with students this afternoon, it was one of the things they were asking me, and here's my list. You can get involved in any of these things, and they will all be aimed at getting people to eat healthier and hopefully to reduce their weight. I have a couple of sort of serious political things on here, like fixing campaign laws and changing Wall Street, which are probably harder for individuals to try to do. But there are plenty of other things that people can do to create a healthier food environment. Big Food has joined Wall Street as part of the Occupy movement, and I've been collecting posters from Occupy Big Food, Occupy the Food System, and on February 27th, a global day of action has been called on Occupy Our Food Supply, ending corporate exploitation of food systems, and they're looking for people to set up demonstrations and to work on these issues everywhere. So if you're interested in getting involved in this, there's a website you can go on it and figure out what you can do. So these are the kinds of things we talk about in our book, coming soon to a bookstore near you. And I thank you very, very much for the honor of speaking to you today. Thank you. But I think the goals of the food industry and the goals of public health are very different. And only seldom are they congruent. What the companies have tried to do is to introduce congruency by making better-for-you products. But I don't think a better-for-you product is necessarily a good choice. It's still a junk food. It may be a slightly better junk food, but it's not a health food. So there's a problem. And one of the ways in which food companies are dealing with the backlash against the kind of thing they're doing is by exporting the marketing. And as I think I've said this several times today, but Coke, Pepsi, McDonald's, and Kraft all within the last year have reported that all of the growth in their profits is coming from overseas sales, most of it in developing countries. So if you can't sell it here, you're going to sell it there. The only way you're going to get people to eat less is by changing the environment so that healthy foods are the default. And unfortunately, healthy foods cost more. Therefore, they're not as profitable. Therefore, the food industry has very little incentive to do that. I think it's a huge problem, but that's why the food movement is so important and why farmers markets, CSAs, local, seasonal, sustainable, organic, and all of those things are really important. Because these are ways in which people can take food and grow your own and cook your own. These are all ways that people can take the food system into their own hands. The things that are subsidized in the United States are corn, soybeans, cotton, wheat, and a couple of other things. These are largely materials that are fed to animals, so they support the meat industry. So the meat industry doesn't have to pay as much for feed as they otherwise would. There are no subsidies for fruits and vegetables. Not only that, but farmers who receive subsidies are not allowed to grow fruits and vegetables. They're forbidden. So we have a system that is set up to promote one kind of food and not another. That could be changed. There have been a number of experiments reducing the price of fruits and vegetables, and those absolutely increase purchases and increase consumption. Both of those have been studied. And, you know, there's a big farmers market coupon campaign to allow the people who are receiving SNAP benefits to get twice the value of their SNAP benefit if they buy fruits and vegetables at farmers markets and so forth. And those things are going national, and there are lots and lots of people who are working on similar initiatives, and they seem to work. Just think about it for a minute. If you eat in a restaurant, you don't have a clue how that food was prepared. I was just handed a cookie from, I guess, one of these places around here, and I tried to do an estimate. I sort of looked at it and kind of weighed it. I think it's a 600-calorie cookie, I think. But I don't really know that. It's only one cookie. It's impossible to tell unless you sit there and weigh the food, weigh the ingredients, and do at-water values and figure out how many calories there are. That's boring. Nobody's going to do that. For any length of time, it's tedious. You don't want to think about calories when you're eating. Eat small. I don't know how else to do it. There are people who claim that they can do calories, but they can't. You know, in every study that's ever been done of estimations of calories versus measurements, usually shows a gap of about 30 to 40%. I see cooking as a form of empowerment. And I don't think people have to cook all the time, but they should cook some. And eating out should be a treat. And when you eat out, you have to watch how much you're being fed, because the amounts are extraordinary. You know, I mean, and at my age, the amounts are not only enough to feed two, they're enough to feed four. You know, I just can't imagine, I can't believe the amount of food that is put in front. And I'm just like everybody else, I eat more if the food's in front of me. Because I like food, I like eating. So the original subsidy system was for these commodities, and then the people who were getting them began to view them as entitlements. And for decades was that there were alliances between large agricultural producers, the House and Senate members of the Agriculture Committee and the Department of Agriculture, and they were very closely knit. All of that became entrenched. But the quick and dirty answer is that you cannot even conceive of a presidential candidate going into the first primary state, which is Iowa, and saying, we're going to end corn and soybean subsidies. Can you imagine anything like that happening? I certainly can't. He'd be thrown out on his ear. Oh, like the people in Kentucky who used to grow tobacco. When the tobacco subsidies ended, Kentucky said, what are we going to do about our agricultural system? What are we going to do? And they started encouraging them to grow specialty vegetables. And that's worked pretty well in Kentucky. There's not as much profit in it, especially if the subsidies aren't there. If the subsidies went to other foods, the farmers would follow the subsidies. Obesity rates have leveled off, except among young men. And watch the marketing of junk food to young men. Just keep an eye on it. It's amazing. Big, 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 huge portions. And that's because they're trying to reach a demographic that's actually eating more. Everybody else has kind of cut back and it's leveling off. So I don't know what will happen with it. I think there's a huge push to try to get people to eat more healthfully. Everybody's looking at ways to make fruits and vegetables more accessible and less expensive. And maybe those will work. They're certainly worth working on, I think. So go out and do it.